This is episode 93 of The Variety Artist. This is John Abrams, your host, and that guy that interviews successful variety artists from around the world every single week. Happy New Year! Or Happy New Decade, I guess. This is my first show with a brand new decade, and I can't think of a better way to start off than with you. Whether you're listening to this driving to a gig, or doing the dishes, or on your computer, I appreciate you subscribing and tuning in every week. Well, I have something special for you today. Pearls of wisdom just roll off the tongue of my guest. You're about to hear some genius ideas from a very unique entertainer. I won't ruin the surprise. We'll just get started. Enjoy the show.
Fun fact number 222. When John was 17, he played the lead role in The Elephant Man.
Welcome to The Variety Artist, providing aspiring artists and entertainers with in-depth discussions from top performers from all over the world. So get ready to book some gigs, make some money, and have some fun with your host, John Abrams.
My guest today is an internationally acclaimed magician who's devoted his life to sharing the experience of mystery with audiences around the world. He's fooled Penn and Teller. He's created and performed his own Cabinet of Curiosities. He's now performing his newest show, Dark Magic. He's best known for his theatrical performing style and his writing and teaching skills. Variety artist, I give you David Parr.
Hi, everyone.
How's it going, David?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. Why don't you tell the people who have not seen you, tell us what exactly that you do.
I'm a magician and actor. That's what I've done most of my life, starting when I was 7 years old. The classic magic origin story. I received a magic set as a gift when I was seven. I was hooked. I had to know more. So I started going to the library and taking out books about magic. And then I discovered that there was a magic shop about 20 miles distant from the house where I grew up. I asked my parents to take me there. And after that, trips to the magic shop became a regular thing. So by the time I was a teenager, around 12 or 13, I was already doing gigs around the city.
Well, how did you go from just doing magic tricks or tricks from books and things to becoming the dark kind of storyteller?
Well, it's funny. When I look back at what sort of attracted me to magic in the first place, it was the spooky aspect of magic. Like the first book about magic that I ever read was a book called Spooky Tricks. It was a scholastic book. Periodically in grade school, they would pass around a list of books that you could purchase in class, and you pay for the book, and then they deliver it to you at school.
Oh yeah.
And it the cover showed a picture of a ghost pulling another ghost out of a top hat. It's so fascinated me because lots of the magic in it was meant to be kind of spooky. At around that time, I was fascinated by monster movies. I saw the old Universal monster movies on Saturday afternoon television.
Yeah.
And so my interest in things that were spooky or weird was intertwined with my interest in magic. When I look back now, look at the origins of how I started in magic, it's like, oh, I've sort of come full circle in the sense that it all comes back to the sort of spooky aspect of magic for me.
Right. Was there a period of time, other than when you were a teenager, that you did the standard magic tricks without the spooky spin?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. There was a period in the early 1980s during the comedy club boom where there were like comedy clubs popping up on every street corner, it seemed. I was a comedy magician. I performed magic in comedy clubs.
Oh.
It was a miserable, miserable experience. I hated it. I bombed a lot. What I discovered was that it wasn't an environment in which I could thrive.
Oh.
It was basically an environment where the game was pander or die.
Right.
And I found that I couldn't pander to what the audience wanted. So I died over and over and over. And the experience was so negative that I finally realized if I keep going in this direction, I'm going to start to resent magic.
Yeah.
So I thought, I need to leave this path. I need to stop doing what I'm doing and start from scratch.
Right.
In looking back on, you know, my childhood and what got me into magic in the first place, I was like, I should be performing spooky stuff. That's really what interested me in magic to begin with.
Yeah.
I discovered that I had sort of gone down a false path or a dead end for me as far as like performing comedy magic in comedy clubs. It wasn't the right path for me.
Well, do you remember that first show that you did where you did more spooky type magic as opposed to the comedy magic? And you said, oh, this is kind of cool. I think I like this.
Yeah, yeah. I remember it distinctly because, you know, I had thought back and thought about the book Spooky Tricks and the aspects of magic that I was attracted to in the beginning when I was young.
Yeah.
And I realized, oh, I have all these ideas for a Halloween show that I've just never gotten a chance to use. So I started thinking in terms of, I should create a show for Halloween that's all, you know, stuff that's fascinated me since I was a kid. And that's, you know, monster movies and weird history and folklore and all that stuff. And coincidentally, as I was thinking about that stuff, I ran into an actor I had worked with in the past, and she said, oh, I just bought this house downtown. We're turning it into a bed and breakfast, my husband and I, and we're building a theater in the basement.
Okay.
And she was like, I'd like to do something fun for Halloween. And I thought, well, this is it.
You're like, ding, ding, ding.
Yeah, yeah. So I was like, oh, I have a show, and which I didn't actually at the time. I hadn't written it yet, but I told her I had a show. Huh? So it was sort of off and running.
Wow, so that was the first one. In fact, I was going to ask you about all the different venues that you do. Mm-hmm. I noticed that a lot of the venues that you do are houses and mansions that may or may not be haunted, that type of thing. How do you go about finding those?
Well, I had this realization, and that's that context changes the game. I thought if I could find a place that had a spooky enough atmosphere, that would enhance the material that I performed there. So in a sense, the show would start before the show even started. The show would start the moment they walked in the door.
The venue has already done some of the work for you.
Exactly, exactly, because of the atmosphere of it.
Right.
I thought, well, that's the place. If I could ideally, what's the ideal environment for that kind of a show, for a Halloween show? And I thought, well, a spooky old house. The audience is already in that frame of mind of, you know, it seems like something weird or supernatural could happen.
Yeah.
And that's before the show even starts.
Wow.
So I started searching around for places like that. You know, one of the things I discovered was that historical societies and places like that often have museums. They're hungry for content. They're hungry for ways to get people in the door.
Hmm.
When I pitched the idea to them, I told them, I can do that. I can bring people in the door who probably normally wouldn't have come here. They'll see that it's a cool place and they'll probably come back.
Yeah, because they've walked out with a terrific experience too.
Right, exactly. I found that that was true. That's exactly what happened. A lot of people who came to see, for example, my show Haunting History at the Dawes House in Evanston, just outside of Chicago, a lot of people commented that in addition to enjoying the show, they wanted to come back and see the house during the day.
Mm.
And those people did come back. It was a way to pitch it to an organization that probably wouldn't have come up with the idea of let's have a magic show here.
Right. And you've created a win-win situation. You know, you win because you get to do a show, or you're doing a show, and they win because they put butts in seats.
Right. I get to take advantage of the fact that a place like that, a spooky old museum, has an atmosphere that you couldn't manufacture.
Wow, that's very smart. Now, how do you come up with your stories and different things? Because I notice watching a lot of your videos, the magic is terrific, but they're all engulfed with this wonderful, full-bodied, spooky kind of story around them. How do you come up with those? Or what is your process? Do you see that? I know there's a lot of questions all at once, but do you see the magic first and then come up with a story? Or do you see a story and then say, oh, you know, this would really work with this particular magic?
It's different every time. The creative process is different each time. And sometimes it does start with a story. It does start with like a piece of folklore or history that I find fascinating and that I've jotted down into my notes as I'd like to use this someday.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, my presentation for the finger chopper has to do with the fact that around the time of the French Revolution, tiny guillotines were being sold as toys. It was a relatively common toy. So that's my way of placing this, what would be a weird magic prop that has no place in the world,
right,
giving it a place in the world. And that was just a bit of history that I had jotted down. But sometimes it starts the opposite way. It starts with a magic effect that I'm fond of and really want to perform. An example of that would be Oswald Ray's flexible glass, the mirror penetration.
Mm-hmm.
I remember seeing Doug Henning do it when I was a kid and being struck by how surreal it was. There's a moment after he's poked a needle through this apparently solid mirror when he takes the mirror and bends it in half, and it looks like the mirror is flexible, turned flexible.
Okay.
Then restores it to a solid mirror. That moment just struck me as so surreal and almost eerie feeling. I'd always wanted to perform that effect. Eventually, it ended up in my Halloween show.
And you found a story that went around that mirror?
Yeah. So what I did was I just immersed myself in research on folklore related to mirrors.
Oh.
What I found was that there was a mountain of it. You'd be hard-pressed to come up with an object that can be found in your household that has more folklore and magical belief attached to it.
Than mirrors, yeah. I would think so.
Yeah, because it's in all the fairy tales and stuff. Mirror, yeah. Mirror on the wall.
Right.
Right. All that stuff. So the challenge really was, how do I sift through and find the bits of folklore I really want in this piece?
Mm-hmm.
It was a matter of just gradually whittling down the mountain of stuff I had to a smaller hill, and that became the piece.
Hmm.
So it's different every time. Human beings are storytelling animals, and that's how we understand the world around us, is by stories. There's no stronger tool than narrative to engage an audience. We're just built to respond to it.
We love stories. You're absolutely right about that. As human beings, we're hardwired to appreciate your stories and to get fascinated and interesting by your stories.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's like pre-programmed in our brain.
You were on Penn and Teller Fool Us, and you fooled them. Tell me about that experience.
So should I go back to the very beginning?
Sure. I don't know where the beginning is.
The beginning is outside of the airport in Chicago when a car went through the crosswalk and hit me.
Oh.
So I was suddenly airborne. And then when I landed, I thought, I'm conscious. I didn't hit my head. I think I'm okay. And then I tried to stand up, and it was the most excruciating pain I've ever felt.
Oh no.
What had happened was that the impact had broken my leg in two places. I was out of commission for 3.5 months. I couldn't walk or drive, and I couldn't do my show every week in Chicago. So like friends of mine stepped in to my show and took my place. I was suddenly cut off from my creative outlet, which it had never happened before. What I discovered is how important that creative outlet is to me, because I was going nuts after a few weeks. I couldn't stand feeling cut off from the world.
I wonder about that for myself, because I do shows almost every weekday. And there are times when I don't do a show for a week or something on an off time, it starts to get me antsy. It starts to drive me crazy. And I don't know what I would do if I had 6 months with no shows, no adrenaline rush, no audience participation, you know, none of that. I don't know what I would do.
Yeah, I was unprepared for what that would do to me psychologically. It really ground away at me. I've realized I need to occupy my mind somehow, or I'm going to go crazy. So I thought, what I'll do is I'll give myself a project so I can focus on that. And the project I gave myself was come up with a new piece of magic from scratch. It had to be something that I could perform in the show when I recovered enough to return. And that meant I had to perform it sitting down, because at that point I would be on crutches.
Yeah.
So I had this bell, this antique hotel desk bell, that was sitting on a shelf for years, and it was just sitting there gathering dust. And every once in a while, I would look at it over the years and think, that's a cool thing. I wonder if there's a way to work it into a magic piece. And then I'd kind of think about it for a minute and give up and get on with my life. After the accident, I had nothing but time on my hands. So I thought, okay, I'm going to give this a real try. So I took this bell off the shelf and I thought, okay, what could I use this for? My first idea turned out to be a promising one. And the idea was, well, if I can find a piece of magic that's turn-based, that's sort of game-like, then I can use the bell as the indicator for the end of a turn. Okay. And so then it was like, well, what magic is turn-based in structure? And there's a plot in magic that magicians call you do as I do.
Right.
And I thought, oh yeah, that's turn-based, because the performer does an action and then the person helping the performer mimics the action. So I thought, okay, now I've got something. And that was off and running, you know, metaphorically, since I couldn't at that
point. It wasn't really running.
Yeah. So that's where it all started. So I, when I went back to the show, we added it to the show and I performed it for about nearly a year before the folks from Fool Us invited me on.
So did you get a call from Fool Us? Did they see you, or how did that come about?
They saw a video of it online. I had pitched them a bunch of ideas, all of which they rejected. And it was all non-card stuff, because I thought, I'm not going to send them card material because they probably see hundreds of card tricks.
Yeah, I would think so.
Yeah, so I was like, okay, I just avoid the card stuff. I sent them all non-card stuff and they rejected every idea. And eventually they saw this video that I had posted of that piece.
Card stuff.
And they were like, that's the one we want. So it was a shock to me. When people ask me for advice, when magicians ask me for advice about how to get on Fool Us, my advice is always this. Pitch them every idea you have. Don't hold things back because you think they might not want it. Right. Because you'll never know what they want until they tell you.
Yeah.
They might be looking for something and a particular type of thing, and I wouldn't know. So the best approach is to cast a wide net by just pitching every idea you have.
Yeah. So you go on the show and you fool them. Does this change the course of your career at all?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Because I run into people all the time who saw me on that show. Hmm. Lots and lots of people watched that show. I think that show has done a lot for magic and the public perception of magic. I run into lay people now who use the phrase close-up magic. They say things like, I like close-up magic. Now, when I was growing up, no one but a magician would have used that phrase.
Mm.
But to hear a layperson say that they like close-up magic means we're now dealing with a more educated audience.
Yeah.
An audience that understands that there's a variety of styles and approaches to performing magic. That didn't exist when I was growing up. A lot of it can be put down to that show that is sort of changed the public perception of what magic is, what it can be. I'm still performing that piece in my shows.
Oh.
And it's at the end, near the end of my Cabinet of Curiosities show. And I always ask the audience how many people watch Fool Us and how many people saw me on that show. And a lot of people are raising their hands.
Well, as long as we're talking about the Cabinet of Curiosities, I had Joe Given and Carol Massey on my show. And they talked about you performing your Cabinet of Curiosities show at their theater. This concept fascinates me. Tell me a little bit about how that show works, or how it looks.
Well, I had this idea in my back pocket for years. It was kind of my dream show for a long time. The idea was I'd have this cabinet or bookshelf on the stage filled with all these weird looking magical artifacts.
Mm-hmm.
And each artifact would have a story. There would be points in the show when the audience would get to pick which artifact we would examine next. To me, that was an appealing idea because it brought a kind of improvisational aspect to the show so that it would be different each time depending on people's choices. And it would also allow a lot of flexibility for swapping in new material and swapping out old material when I wanted to. There were lots of possibilities with a structure like that.
Yeah.
I sort of kept it in my back pocket for years, kind of keeping an eye out for a place where I could try it. I was performing a show called The Magic Cabaret in a theater in Chicago for 10 years. When we decided to wrap up that show, around that time, the folks who were building the Chicago Magic Lounge, which is a theater in Chicago that's completely devoted to magic, contacted me and said, hey, we're building this multi-million-dollar theater devoted to magic. Pick a day of the week and the stage is yours.
And what a deal.
And I thought, oh, well, here's the opportunity. I can finally try that idea. So I told them I have a concept for a show and a title. And it was David Parr's Cabinet of Curiosities.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, yeah, that sounds great. So I said, how about Wednesdays? And that's how I started it.
Wow.
There's about 20 years of material in that cabinet, all jammed in there. It's there's a lot of me in that show.
How many pieces is in each show, like, about?
I think 10.
Oh.
I'm guessing 10 or 11, something like that.
Okay.
It's an hour-long show.
Do you have anything pre-planned, like you know that they're going to pick this particular item or something as a finale?
Yeah, some of the show is structured and the same every time. Like where the show begins and where the show ends in particular are the same every time. You know, what I discovered was the show needs to have a structure.
Sure.
That's the foundation of it. And then there can be within that or on top of that, there can be parts of the show that are changeable.
Got it.
That's the stuff in the middle where people get to pick an item from the cabinet. That was super fun because then each show is different. People are encouraged to come back and see you know, the stuff from the cabinet that didn't get chosen on that particular show.
Yeah. If I'm in the audience and I'm looking it up there and there's an old doll that you didn't use, I want to see what you do with that next time.
Right. Right. Yeah. It was modeled a little bit after one of the shows I grew up watching, and that was Rod Serling's Night Gallery.
Oh yeah. At
the beginning of that show, Rod Serling's walking through this old museum at night, and he's passing all these paintings as he's walking and doing his intro. I always wondered, well, but what's that painting and that one, the ones he was passing by?
Yeah.
Right. And then he finally comes to stand next to a painting, and he describes the painting and its title. And then you're into the episode.
Right.
It was like, I want to see the other stuff in the museum.
So tune in next week when we visit this other painting.
Yeah, exactly. So that's kind of what part of the inspiration for that show.
Well, let's talk about your different shows then. What is, you mentioned it earlier, what is Haunting History? Wait, before you tell me what it is, let me tell you what Downtown Edition said: an eerie and inventive melodrama exploring the supernatural, the very stuff of which Halloween is made. Okay, that laugh I put in there myself.
It was good, by the way. You've been working on your evil laugh.
Yeah, since I was about 14.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Me too. The Halloween show, Haunting History, was a collection of magic related to weird history and folklore from the past. History is much weirder than the version we learn in school. The tidbit I mentioned earlier about how the little miniature guillotines were a common toy around the time of the French Revolution is just one example. There are many, many examples of that kind of stuff. You don't hear this kind of stuff in school. Yeah. The show took place in an old mansion just outside of Chicago. The audience moved from room to room of the house, and in each room, an effect would take place. And then we'd move to the next room and the next. And finally, the show ended up in the center of the house where there was a séance.
Mm.
When I was a kid in high school and in my early college years, I worked at walk-through haunted houses.
Oh, yeah.
That were like charities during the Halloween season. I always remembered that experience of, you know, the crowd walking through the haunted house, and in each, you know, little room, something spooky would happen. I thought, you know, that's a structure that would work for a magic show.
Yeah.
So that's basically what I did, was I borrowed that structure of a walk-through haunted house, except I used it for a magic show. And it was a blast, because I got to sort of return to my days of doing spooky things in old houses like I did when I was growing up.
I have to stop you there for a second, only because the things that you're describing are so fascinating to me. When we think of a magic show, a lot of folks think of, well, here I am on a stage. I'm going to do a show in front of an audience. That's what it is. Whereas you've taken that scenario, sure, and dumped it on its ear, going through a house, having a cabinet of curiosities, way different formats than we think of in our head.
What I don't want is for my audience to be passive spectators. I don't want that. They can get that by watching television,
yeah,
or YouTube. What I want is for them to be participants in the drama that's unfolding.
Mm.
One of the ways to do that is to break down the fourth wall of theater so that that doesn't exist anymore, that they're in the scene. So I thought, well, an easy way to do that would be to structure it like a walkthrough haunted house. It's easy to stay a passive spectator and sort of feel distant from the action when you're sitting in a darkened theater and the performer can't see you.
Yeah.
But it's another matter entirely when you're standing next to him in the same room. There's none of the formal parameters of a theater. Now, if the performer starts eating razor blades,
it's hard to stay a passive observer.
Yeah.
Because you could basically stop me from doing that crazy thing by just reaching over and putting a hand on my arm and telling me to stop.
Mm-hmm.
So it puts the audience in a different position.
And it also lends itself to more improv on your part because you are working with the audience one-on-one as opposed to presenting to a big audience.
Yeah.
Tell me about Visions of Poe.
That was basically, we took that same structure and put a different theme in there. So instead of being about weird supernatural history and folklore, it was all based on stories and poems by Edgar Allan Poe. Poe has been one of my favorite authors ever since I was a kid. That was another dream project.
Has anything really spooky happened to you that you didn't cause?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. In fact, I was just telling this story the other night to a friend of mine. You know, every once in a while, something happens during the show that you didn't plan. And when you enter this sort of spooky territory, the audience sort of, they latch on to any little thing that happens, and that to them becomes part of the performance. And that's how this stuff works. What you do is you set up an expectation or anticipation that something weird might happen. And then that gets all the audience's imagination going so that then any little thing that happens seems meaningful to them and part of the performance.
Sure. Well, I'm dying to know what happened.
So there was one of the shows in this old mansion where I'm doing the seance part. At the end of it, we had blacked out the room so that there wouldn't be any light in it. So we were doing like a full dark seance. So I'm reciting this Edgar Allan Poe poem, the poem Alone. We're in the dark and there's about a phenomena are about to start happening. And as I'm reciting the poem that leads into all the fun, spooky stuff that's about to happen, I start to notice, wait a minute, I'm starting to be able to see. I can see things in the room, like outlines of things. And I'm like, wait a minute, where could there be light? There's no light source in here. Where is that coming from? So I'm continuing with my lines, but I'm looking around, like trying to find the source of this light in the room. And I can't find it. So I was just like, I don't know what's happening. I'm just going to have to get through this quickly before everyone's eyes adjust and it ruins this section of the show. So I sort of galloped through the end of the show, the last 10 minutes or so of the show, to get through it as quickly as possible, and then wrapped it up. And afterward, when the lights were on again, a guy came up to me. He was like, that was amazing. And he started to describe to me what he had seen. What he saw was, as I was sitting there on the stage, an orange sort of glow started happening behind me that silhouetted me in the room. Now, there was nothing behind me but a brick wall. There was just a brick wall behind me. There was no way the light could have been coming through from anywhere. So he said, wow. I could see your silhouette, and it was there was this sort of glow around you. And he was like, I have no idea how you did that. And I just, you know, what I've learned over many, many years of performing magic is that when the universe hands you godlike powers, you just take credit for it.
Thank you very much.
Right. So I said, well, I'm not telling. It turned out that he was a reporter for a university newspaper. Hmm. So the description of that effect, the weird glowing effect, ended up in the review of the show. And none of that was planned.
Did anybody come to the show later or another time saying, oh, I read this great review and I didn't see that orb behind you or your silhouette?
Well, that's the funny thing, is because once you introduce an idea like that into people's heads, they'll see it whether it happens or not. If they expect to see it, they'll see it. Because that's what our minds do. We see what we expect to see. So people after that reported seeing that effect happen when it didn't happen.
That's great.
All of this is a lesson in the power of the human imagination. If you can engage people's imagination to the point where they're basically creating the show in their minds, that's the ideal.
All right, we're going to play a little game called Fact or Something John Just Made Up. Sound like fun?
Okay.
Is it fact? Or is it something John just made up?
Okay, here's what's going to happen. I'm going to give you a headline, and you're going to tell me whether it's true or not. And if it is true, tell me a little more about it.
Okay.
First headline. David was a werewolf in a haunted house at the state fair.
That is true. That is a fact.
Oh, how did that happen? Or tell me about that.
Like I said, I grew up working in walk-through haunted houses during the Halloween season. And then when I was in college, I discovered that there was a haunted attraction at the state fair during the summer. So some friends and I went and applied to work there.
Oh,
they were like thrilled to discover that I knew stuff about theatrical makeup and all that. So they were like, oh, great. Pick a role. What do you want to do? And I was like, I want to be a werewolf.
Sure.
When I was a kid, seeing the movie The Wolfman with Lon Chaney Jr. was like, that was an extremely memorable experience.
Oh, yeah. And the special effects back then, he changed into the werewolf right on screen in front of your face.
Right. And I remembered finding books about special effects and reading about how, you know, Jack Pierce painstakingly glued yak hair to Lon Chaney Jr.'s face. And I just, to me as a kid, I was like, that sounds like fun. And
who doesn't want yak hair on their face?
Right. So the haunted house at the state fair was my opportunity to finally to fulfill that fantasy of gluing yak hair to my face. So I was a werewolf for a number of years, a number of summers at the state fair.
Ironically, there is somebody who has a fan question, and we'll get to that in a minute. But Rob Balchunas, who has the fan question, he works as, I'm not sure, maybe a zombie or something, Universal Studios here during Halloween, ironically.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Cool. Yeah, I miss those days. You know, part of creating the Haunting History show that, you know, went from room to room of an old spooky house was my effort to recapture those walk-through haunted house days, which I kind of miss.
Yeah.
It was a fantastic experience. People do weird stuff when they're scared. Like I saw grown-ups like basically get down on all fours and crawl past the room where the werewolf was to try and sneak past without the werewolf seeing them.
Oh, that's great.
These are grown people crawling on the floor to try to get past the werewolf. It was a great experience.
It sounds fun. And in fact, there's a YouTube video, or a few of them now, where someone has a camera set up at an extra scary part of a haunted house. They'll show different cuts of different people screaming and yelling in terror. And to me, it's funny. To them, it may not be. I don't know.
Yeah, it's so much fun. The thing was, when I was a kid, I had such a vivid imagination that stuff like that really scared the life out of me. If I read a comic book that was spooky, I wouldn't be able to sleep for the rest of the week.
Mm.
Before I saw just a little bit or even an advertisement for a film, for a horror movie,
yeah,
would give me nightmares. But at the same time, I was fascinated by that stuff.
Mm.
So it was like always fascination and fear in equal measure for me.
Mm.
And I think part of why I was drawn to working at these haunted houses when I was young, it was a way of finally confronting those fears and getting past them. Because in those cases, I built the haunted house. I helped, you know, nail the walls together and all that stuff. So I saw it when it went from a raw space into being built into this thing. And then the special effects and the lighting and the sound effects were all added. And I participated in setting those up too. And then finally, I'm one of the monsters in it. So now I've gotten a peek behind the curtain. I've gotten to be behind the curtain. It loses its power to scare me. The people who are coming through the haunted house are on the opposite side of the curtain now. They're the ones who will be scared. So I think part of what drew me to that was it was a way to confront all those fears from when I was a kid.
You know, when I was a kid, I saw the movie The Exorcist.
Oh, wow.
I think I saw it way too young.
Yeah.
I did not sleep in my own bed for a month or two after I saw that.
Oh, for sure. That would have totally scarred me for life.
Yeah. It scarred me for a long, long time.
Yeah. Yeah. No, my parents wisely kept me from seeing that movie. I didn't see that movie until I was in college.
Yeah. I can't blame it on my parents because I probably snuck into it when I was a kid.
No, I would have done something dumb like that too.
Yeah.
Because I was always fascinated by the stuff that scared me.
All right. Next headline. David swears he saw a real ghost when he was 11 years old.
That is not true.
Oh,
although it could have happened. It seems like something that could have happened.
You know, when I made that up, I said to myself, well, I'm making this up, but maybe it did happen. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. I had quite a vivid imagination, so that could have happened.
All right, next headline. David had a pizza delivered to Edgar Allan Poe's grave.
That is true. It happened relatively recently, too. I was booked at a Bizarre Magic convention in Baltimore. Vince Wilson, who runs the conference, it's called Bizarre Hauntings, also does a ghost tour of the city. The ghost tour ends in the cemetery where Edgar Allan Poe is buried.
Mm-hmm.
And so one night we went on his tour. Some of the magicians from the conference went on his tour, and after it wrapped up, it's late at night, and we were all like, well, I'm kind of hungry. Should we order a pizza or something? And so we found a place with vegan pizza because I'm vegan, and we found a place with vegan pizza that would deliver late. So we gave them basically the street corner. That's the corner where his gravesite is. So we waited for the guy to deliver the pizza. And at one point within the hour, we see a car drive up the street and then stop like up the block from us. And the car just sat there. And I thought, I wonder if that's the delivery guy.
Mm-hmm.
So I call him on the phone and I'm like, is that you that we see up the street? And he's like, yeah, I can't find the address that you gave us. There's nothing here but a cemetery. And I was like, yeah, that's where we are.
That's me talking on the phone, waving my arms.
Right,
that's-
right. We're at the graveyard. So he drove down the street to where we were. and delivered the pizza to Edgar Allan Poe's grave. And and we had a little picnic, a late night picnic, pizza picnic at the cemetery.
I would like to see that pizza guy going back to the pizza place telling that story.
Right, right. Yeah, he got a good story to tell that night.
All right, last one. David once put his hand into the La Brea tar pits.
That is true.
Well, first, tell us, I know what the La Brea tar pits are because they're near my house, and I've been there 10 or 12 times. Tell us what the La Brea tar pits are.
Yeah, it's a natural formation of like an asphalt substance that's has remained liquid in the ground. If you look at it, it just looks like water, basically. Mm-hmm. It looks like a small pond. But beneath the surface of the water that's sort of floating on the top, there's basically tar. And so prehistoric animals would step into this to like either get a drink or bathe or to see if they could find food in there. And they get stuck and they get sink in and die. And then their bones and stuff would be preserved in this asphalt. You can go to the museum there in LA at the tar pits, and they've got the collection of all the artifacts they've dug out of those tar pits. And it's this amazing mass of prehistoric creatures.
Well, one of the reasons they suggest that there is such a mass of creatures is the one animal would come and take a drink of the water and then get stuck and start to struggle. And then another animal that was hunting that animal would jump on top of him and start to eat him and start to attack him. And he would get stuck also.
Get trapped also, right.
And then
right.
The third one would come. And so then there were piles and piles and piles of animals.
Right, right. And all it takes is one animal to basically bait the trap.
Right.
And then more would get stuck.
Yeah.
I had been fascinated by the La Brea tar pits and dinosaurs and stuff ever since I was a kid. I, you know, in addition to the Universal Monster models that Aurora made and I had all of when I was a kid, they also made these dinosaur scenes. And one of the scenes that I had that was a model kit was the La Brea tar pits.
Mm.
It showed like a woolly mammoth or something, like trapped in the tar pit and sinking in. So I'd had a fascination with it ever since I was a kid. So when I went out to LA to work the Magic Castle the first time, I was like, I have to stop and see the La Brea tar pits.
Oh yeah.
So I went there and I went to the museum, and then, you know, around the back of the museum basically are the tar pits themselves.
Yeah.
They're fenced off. I discovered that one of the fences was open. Well, there was a significant enough gap that you could go through it.
It was an invitation just asking you to go through there.
Well, I have this thing where if a door is marked no admittance, I want to go through it.
Mm-hmm.
I want to know what's behind that door. Like, my friends know that if they're out with me in a public place, like a concert venue or a museum or something like that, and there's a door that you're not supposed to go through, I'll test the door to see if it's locked.
There goes David into that door again.
Yeah, yeah. And if it's unlocked, I'll open it and check it out, because I have to know. So for me, exploring unlabeled staircases that lead to somewhere, I want to explore that. And so when I saw this gap in the fence that was big enough to get through, I was like, okay. I went through. I was like, I wonder, you know, because it just looks like water, the tar pit.
Yeah.
So I was like, I wonder what it feels like. So I reached down and I stuck my hand in it.
Oh no.
So now I can report from experience. It's the consistency of molasses and about the same color. You know, when I pulled out my hand, it looked like I had stuck my hand in molasses, but it smells like, you know, when you pass a city crew that's laying asphalt or tarmac.
Oh, yeah.
That burning creosote smell, yeah. That's what it smells like.
Oh, lovely.
Okay, now how do I clean my hand off? Right? So yeah. So I wipe my hand on the grass nearby, but this stuff is super sticky. It doesn't come off easily.
It's tar.
Right. It's liquid tar. I'm grabbing clumps of grass and using it to wipe off my hand. So I finally got my hand, and then I went into the museum and into the bathroom in there and washed my hand off with some soap. But what I discovered was that the smell of it just clung to my hand. It just wouldn't go away. So for the rest of the day, my hand smelled like I had stuck my hand in a tar pit.
I used to take my kids there quite often. If you've ever been behind the La Brea tar pits, which you obviously were,
yeah.
There are little patches of pits, and you could, or maybe they're little pieces that people wipe their hands on the grass on.
People like me.
And we accidentally step on them. So whenever we'd go, we'd look at the bottom of our shoes, and sure enough, there'd be tar on the bottom of our shoes.
Yeah.
And so we'd say, we've been tarred. We've been tarred. Oh, no. What do? We've been tarred. I think we lost more shoes that way.
At the time, it was like, oh, what's the worst that can happen? They tell you you don't belong here and they kick you out.
Yeah. Yeah. Not so bad.
So if that's the worst consequence, why not try it?
I'll bet a bunch of people listening to this are going to try that and get themselves in trouble. I'll be getting all sorts of messages and things.
Oh, great. Yeah. Yeah.
That was fact. Or something John just made up.
Every time I interview somebody new, I put on my Facebook group, the Variety Arts Community Facebook group, that you can ask questions of our guests.
Okay.
And most of the people wrote really nice things and nice comments about you. I won't bore you with those. Maybe I should. I don't know.
These are on your Facebook page?
Yes, exactly.
I'll have to go and read them. I didn't know.
Yeah, take a look there. There's some very nice things about you.
Huh.
But you did have a fan question. The fan question was from Rob Balchunas, who we mentioned earlier, who plays the zombie or one of the scary characters at Universal. He is also Rob the Balloon Guy. He asks, what are some of the things people don't think about when producing their own show?
When you're producing your own work, you have to wear all the hats. You're not only the star of the show, you're the writer, you're the director, you are the promoter and PR person, you know, basically the publicist for the show. You're the set designer, you're the costume designer, you're all those things. You have all those roles to fill. So sometimes one or two of those roles can sort of fall through the cracks because you're busy with other ones. So sure. It's important to remember that you have to devote time to all of those roles. For example, I've learned to become the master of the quotable press release. This is one of the skills that I found I had to develop because I'm promoting my own work.
Right.
If I write a press release and include what looks like direct quotes from me,
mm-hmm.
quotes that seem like somebody interviewed me, then a lazy reporter can basically take those quotes out of my press release, put them in print, and it looks like that person interviewed me.
Got it.
A lot of times an article will be run about one of my shows and it's quoted straight out of my press release. Because the reporter didn't have time to actually do an interview with me. So this is a way to pretend that they did.
Right.
And it's all quotes straight out of my press release. So if you read one of my press releases, there are parts of it that look like interviews.
That's really smart because it makes it look like the reporter did his job, makes it look like he did a lot of work.
Right.
Even though he did not have.
Right. So I make it very easy for that person to just to get this stuff into print.
Right. That's great advice. So do you have some other advice for the beginner or working pro, either one?
My advice to both is to find your creative voice. Find what you have to say that other people don't have to say.
Hmm.
Part of discovering that is to go back to the past. What drew you to magic in the first place? When I've talked about this with other magicians and mentioned that for me, it was the dark side of magic, the spooky side of magic that attracted me to it. But there were other magicians where it was like magic to them was an escape from the dark parts of life.
Sure.
For them, it was like the light. It was puppies and rainbows was magic to them. So my advice was go back to that place where you first became interested in magic and look at the magic you were doing back then. And see if there's some of it that you still feel drawn to. Over the past 20 years or so, I've done a lot of reclaiming magic that I was doing between the ages of 7 and 13.
Mm.
A lot of it was classic, solid magic effects. Well, I think I stopped doing these because I associated them with childhood. And so I thought, when I grew up, I was supposed to do grown-up magic and set aside this childhood magic. That's not a valid reason for discarding those effects. So I've gone back and I've reclaimed a lot of the magic I was doing. I've reclaimed some of the magic from the book Spooky Tricks is now in my repertoire because that's where my passion for magic started.
Yeah.
Mining our past, particularly the period where we were first attracted to magic, is a fertile source for new material and for discovering our voice. You know, by the time I was a teenager, I was doing paid gigs.
Hmm.
And then it becomes a business in magic becoming our work and our source of income. It's easy to lose sight of the creative or artistic aspect of it. The fact that it's a means of self-expression, of sharing who I am with my audience. And I think it's important to remember that and be in touch with that.
Well, now how about a recommended book?
Well, I think because one of the hats we have to wear is script writer, one of the ways we can learn to become a good writer is by being a good reader.
Hmm.
You know, I've been a voracious reader all my life. When I think back to the authors who I loved and still love to this day, I've always looked at their writing with an analytical mind. I can remember reading Ray Bradbury's stories when I was a kid. And he's still one of my favorite authors ever. Thinking about how did this work? Why did this work for me? Why did this story creep me out?
Yeah.
I was analyzing what made it tick. I think that's important to learning how to be a good writer. I'd recommend reading anything by Ray Bradbury, but particularly his short story collection, The Illustrated Man, his collection of spooky stories called The October Country. But if you want an author who's a sort of a modern day Ray Bradbury type, I'd recommend Stephen Milhauser. And my favorite of his books is called The Knife Thrower and Other Stories. The movie The Illusionist was based on one of his stories.
I'm going to put a couple of Ray Bradbury books and Stephen Milhauser.
Yeah. It's S-T-E-V-E-N. And then the last name is M-I-L-L-H-A-U-S-E-R. Stephen Milhauser.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm going to put his book, Knife Thrower and Other Stories. I'm going to put both of those on my website so someone can just take a quick look, see that you referred those and click on them and read away.
Cool.
Well, thank you, sir, for doing my show. That was really, really fun. I enjoyed that a lot.
Oh, I had a great time. And like I said, I could talk about magic all day.
I could too, but I don't know if my listeners could hear for 3 or 4 hours. Well, maybe they could. They could probably listen to you for 2 or 3 hours, but not me. Before I let you go, do you have any social media or anything else you'd like to promote?
Sure. First of all, there's my website, which is davidparr.com. And then I am on Facebook. My Facebook page, my fan page is That David Parr. It's at That David Parr. Then my Instagram handle is at Parr Magic. Any one of those three things or all of them are ways to keep up with what my projects are.
Perfect. And before I let you go, by the way, go to David's website and he has all sorts of terrific, amazing products. Some of them started out originally as books and he's converted them into digital downloads for you. Are they digital downloads? Or are they?
Yeah, they're like eBooks. Yes. Yeah.
So you can have them immediately. Very, very cool stuff. And thanks to all my variety artists. If you found this podcast valuable, spread the word. Make sure to go to my website at thevarietyartist.com and take a look at the books that David recommended. And while you're there, take a look at all the books my guests recommended. They're all there. Just click on the one you want and it'll take you to Amazon to order the exact book you want. And thanks again, David, for hanging out with me.
Cool. Let's do this again sometime.
We shall. And now go out and book those gigs, make some money, and have some fun.
That's all for this episode of The Variety Artist, but your journey continues on our website. Go to thevarietyartist.com for more strategies, insight, and resources, as well as show notes on today's guest to assist you in your career. We'll see you on the next episode of The Variety Artist, but until then, go out and book those gigs, make some money, and have some fun.